Our first speakers are going to bring that perspective to their talk, what we can learn from the non-lawyers. And our first speaker is Michelle Minnis, who is directing a program at the University of New Mexico Law School. So that if I lose my drift, you'll have something to hang on to, because I'm going to approach this theme obliquely. I don't know about the rest of you, but I often have a problem with morale in teaching legal writing. It disappoints me that there is not more joyful energy displayed by the teachers and the students in legal writing courses. And so I find I have to kind of pep myself up with these little talks to myself. And I say things like, next fall, by gum, we're going to have a winner of a writing course. Those first-year students will love it. Between classes, they'll cluster in the halls and in the forum in small groups spontaneously, and they'll read each other's papers. They'll read each other's hypotheticals that they've written the night before, and they'll laugh and they'll jibe each other. And they'll even, wonder of wonders, infect the faculty with their enthusiasm for writing. That's how it plays in my fantasies. And I have a hard time letting go of those visions. Earlier this week, they clouded my mind as I thought about speaking with you. I was eager for a fresh perspective on the first-year writing program. And I took an informal survey of the first four law professors who passed by me. At the University of New Mexico, incidentally, the first-year writing course is taught by the faculty, by 26 faculty members, in small sections of four students per section. Anyway, I asked each of these professors the same question. How would you define the problem that an effective legal writing program, first-year legal writing program, would solve? All of them answered the same. They said that the first semester students needed to learn the stylistic conventions that distinguish legal writing from other forms of written discourse, and that a few entering students also needed intensive review of the mechanics of English prose. As one professor put it, a first semester writing program should teach what counts in writing, in legal writing, and what doesn't count. A statement that begins, "It's not fair," doesn't count. A statement that begins, "It doesn't follow," might. These are reasonable, appropriate goals, surely as much as one could hope to accomplish in one semester. I feel a little chagrined to admit, though, that I answered my own question differently. And I think that is because I think of these students in the first year writing program not so much as future lawyers engaged in the study of writing, but as future writers who happen to be engaged in the study of law. From that perspective, I think it's a problem that first semester students do not experience their power as writers. That they, like some of their professors, think of writing almost as some sort of a necessary evil, as a nasty-tasting medicine, something to be got through on the way to the important stuff, the law. Sure, writing's hard, but it's, Land is such a wonderful teacher. Let's consider whether there might be some way to accomplish both the professor's goals and my goals in a single legal writing program. I can't think of the first semester writing course without thinking of the whole first semester law curriculum. How is it that the first formal exposure to the law so often leaves students doubtful of their abilities, rather than hopeful and confident? There are surely many reasons for this malaise among the students, but one of them is bound to be that tradition in legal education of devaluing learning and experiences that students bring to law school. On the theory, I guess, that a slate rubbed clean of all past associations is somehow necessary to learning the law. That's a low-down kind of a trick to pull on a writer. Here's why I say that. Lynn, could you turn this on? When I imagine a writer writing, this is what I see. This is sort of a model of, I don't know what all, consciousness maybe. These words inside the dotted line are what I'm going to use here as to indicate the words, the visible part of writing. These are words that the writer has just written. They're on paper. These words around the outside represent the reservoir from which the written words have been drawn, all the past thoughts and memories, and some of them having already been forced into words, some of them still just drifting out there. But these written words, the ones that appear on paper, have come out of here. And they're floating in this field. It's just like a sea. The dotted line separates the written from the unwritten words. I think of that as sort of a semi-permeable membrane. And it's the writer who decides what comes up from here, what comes up from down here, and gets up into the text. And it's the writer who decides what to toss back down under. And often, what happens is that many of these thoughts and words and memories are remote. Some of them are close to consciousness, some of them are very remote and tangled in memories. And it is through the process of writing, of stirring up that sea by taking things, thoughts, and pushing them, bringing them up to the text and seeing them, that writing becomes a teacher for the writer. And that's what it does. It unsettles that sea. And so just keep this in mind as I continue to talk. Ernest Hemingway once used a metaphor that was very similar to this crude graphic metaphor that I've drawn. An interview once asked Hemingway about his off hours. So, the interviewer said, when you're not writing, you remain constantly the observer, looking for something which can be of use. Hemingway answered, "Surely, if a writer stops observing, he is finished. But he does not have to observe consciously nor think how it will be useful. Perhaps that would be true at the beginning, but later everything he sees goes into the great reserve of things he knows or has seen. If it is any use to know it, I always try to write on the principle of the iceberg. There is 7/8 of it underwater for every part that shows. Anything you know, you can eliminate. And it only strengthens your iceberg. It is the part that doesn't show. If a writer omits something because he does not know it, then there is a hole in the story. I'm going to play a little bit with that quotation from Hemingway, because something happened to me yesterday that was very interesting, and it turns out to be a good illustration of what I'd like to say today. On the plane from Albuquerque, I reread that quote for maybe the 500th time. I read it 10 years ago, and I've been reading it off and on ever since. I like it. I like what it says. Intuitively, it seems to make sense to me. But yesterday when I read it, I asked myself, do I really understand it? Let's go back over the last part, because that's the part that seems, maybe he didn't understand it. Maybe he discovered that if he went through the process I did. Anything you know, you can eliminate, and it only strengthens your iceberg. It's the part that doesn't show. If a writer omits something because he does not know it, then there is a hole in the story. When I reread that yesterday, I thought I understood it. I thought I understood what Hemingway meant. I thought he meant that if there is something down here that you know, you can eliminate it up here in the text. And when you eliminate it, you don't hurt the text. What you do is not indifferent to the text. It strengthens the text. So, what you know down here, you can eliminate or throw out up here, and it won't affect, except in a positive way, the text. But if you don't know it down here, and it, of course, doesn't appear up here, there's a hole in the story. Now, that's a really curious kind of set of relationships, it seems to me. After I had worked it out with a little drawing, I thought, now I've got it. Now I understand this. At least I understand it. I think I understand it in the terms in which Hemingway expressed it. But then I applied my own preaching to myself and said, if I really understand this, how would I explain it to somebody else? How many different ways can I think of to express those relationships in words different from the ones that Hemingway used, to retain his meaning in a different form? So I got out a pad and started writing. I started searching for new words to say this thing. I worked at this for at least an hour, and I only came up with one other way, one analog, but I know there are thousands. And mine was very close to Hemingway's. It was very much like his in that it still refers to writers and writing. But I know there are many others I could probably eventually think of, you could too, that have nothing to do with writing, but that still say the same thing as what he had said. Anyway, I'll tell you my analog. I'm not even sure it's accurate, but this is what I came up with. If a writer knows the conventions of punctuating English prose, she can break those conventions and the text will be stronger for it. That's what I thought the first part said. Ooh, this is troublesome. Why is that? It's because knowing the conventions, she knows her reader's expectations, and she knows the effect on the reader, can anticipate the effect on the reader of breaking those conventions. She knows, for example, that if she punctuates a sentence fragment as if it were a sentence, it will catch the careful reader's attention. And if it is her purpose to catch the careful reader's attention with the meaning in that fragment, then breaking the convention will do it. Thus, her text will be stronger for something she knows but knowingly disregards for some purpose. On the other hand, the writer who doesn't know the conventions of punctuation and repeatedly breaks them in the text repeatedly distracts the reader's attention, and for no good reason. I don't know if I would use Hemingway's phrase and say that there's a hole in the story exactly, but this unknowing breaking of convention weakens the text. It weakens the reader's confidence in the writer. Okay, That's my analog for the last four lines of Hemingway's quote. I've deliberately traced with you the history of my writing this analog to illustrate that I didn't know what I thought I knew until I had to struggle to express it in writing. The process through which I discovered that I could say what I thought I knew is a critically important process for law students to practice. The process of translating relationships from one set of words into another. I won't need this anymore, so if you want, you can turn the lights back on. This translating ability is a skill in which lawyers are expected to excel. For example, a lawyer must be able to extract from a client's account of events and situations, the client's story, those events of legal significance. That is, the lawyer must be able to detect which facts in the client's case hook into the law. He must discern the essential relationships between fact and law that make this interpersonal dispute a legal dispute. But of course, that's not all. The lawyer must not only recognize these essential relationships, he must communicate them. He must be able to explain them to his client, to other lawyers, and possibly to a jury or to persons who have little understanding of legal concepts. An excellent measure of a lawyer's grasp of the essential relationships in a legal dispute is precisely his ability to communicate these relationships several different ways. His ability to recast these relationships for different audiences. To do this, a lawyer must not only see the world the way lawyers see it and be fluent in the language of law, he must also see the world the way non-lawyers see it. He must be able to move back and forth across the boundaries of those worlds, adapting his language, his words for explaining legal relationships as he goes. The best way I know to develop and exercise that ability to move back and forth across these language boundaries, keeping one's meaning intact, is to heighten awareness of those boundaries through writing assignments that require writers to demonstrate recognition of an essential legal meaning by communicating that meaning to different audiences. I'll give you some examples of assignments that I think would exercise this translating skill. Some of them are just pretty simple-minded. Brief a case three different ways. Once for yourself, once for your law professor, and once for your Auntie M. And compare the differences in the way you explain the relationships that are essential to that case in the three different papers. Here's another one. Summarize a series of cases. Case X and its progeny, as the law students are fond of saying. Summarize a series of cases as a ballad. Make each verse a case brief, and the refrains between the verses the holdings. If this were done well, the changing refrain, verse to verse, would show how courts have banked off successive cases in justifying their conclusions. One more. Make a list of legal relationships you have learned in one law course, contracts, let's say. In a second column, next to each entry in the first list, write an analog derived from one of your other law courses. That might give you, for instance, X is to Y in contracts as O is to B in civil procedure. Then in a third column, write for each pair of analogs in the first two columns an analog derived from observation of your physical or social environment. Thus, you might have X is to Y in contracts as O is to B in civil procedure, as R is to L in square dancing or basketball or something else. I have, incidentally, a whole packet of these assignments or similar ones over there, and you're welcome to them. Thank you. These are difficult assignments, as difficult as any of I've seen in first semester law courses. But they're not the kinds of assignments law professors usually give. In law school, the emphasis on translating ability usually goes one way. Students are expected to express legal meaning in legal language for a reader in the legal community, law professors. When law professors neglect to exploit their students' reservoirs of past learning in teaching the students new legal stuff, I think they lose out and the students lose out. I think the faculty's goals for the first semester legal writing the goals I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, that students learn the stylistic conventions distinguishing legal writing from other forms of writing, could be accomplished by deliberately focusing the student's attention on similarities and differences between using legal language to express legal meaning and using non-legal language to express legal meaning. I think that approach would serve my goal as well, the goal of giving students a taste of their power as writers. I'll end with a poem that expresses, in other words, the words I hope my words have conveyed. It's by a gardener and Zen poet named Gary Snyder. And it's called On Top. On top. All this new stuff goes on top. Turn it over. Turn it over. Wait and water down. From the dark bottom, turn it inside out. Let it spread through. Sift down. Even. Watch it sprout. A mind like compost. Thank you.
The next speaker is Lynn Squires, who is from the University of Washington. I have the distinction, I think, of being the... Can you hear me? Is it working? Don't need it? Can you hear me? Okay. I just assume not full with it.
No, they need it for the plug-in.
Oh, okay.
That'll be fine.
That'll work?
Sure.
Okay. As I was saying, I have the distinction of being the only law student on this faculty. So I can speak from the other side of the fence, talk to you about what it feels like to go through a legal research and writing course. I'm going into my third and I'm happy to say final quarter of law school this year. So I took the University of Washington's basic legal skills course 2 years ago, and that after I had taught that basic legal skills course at the University of Washington for 4 years. So it was kind of a topsy-turvy experience graduating from the faculty into the student body. And I wasn't sure whether my status really, I was really demoted or promoted by the by the whole process. I'm still not sure. I can't tell you my grade in basic legal skills because I didn't have the courage to take one. I took it pass-fail, so. we've got no objective criterion for measuring it. Anyway, my summary of that experience is that it was hard. It was unexpectedly hard. And I set out my second year to try to reform our basic legal skills program because I thought it was too hard. The main problem that I would address if I were to teach that course again is the first year, first quarter, or first semester law students' difficulty in learning many new tasks simultaneously. I think it's hard for you if you've been out of law school and you've been writing about the law for some period of time. It's hard to remember how many different things you had to learn for the first time when you first wrote about the law. And I was already familiar with it, so my difficulty has to be you've got to magnify that for those people who have no experience with legal writing and who are seeing a brief or a memo for the first time ever. I went into it with a notion of how these things ought to look, so I knew what the end product, I had some models for myself of what I was aiming at. I knew where I wanted to be when I finished, but I didn't know how to get there. And the process of learning how to analyze legal material, the conventions of writing, enormous problems in organization, learning an entirely new system of research, which is extremely sophisticated. All of these things have to happen at once before you can produce a single paragraph. And it's the complexity and difficulty of all these things at once that I think leads to the kind of anguish that first-year students experience in their legal writing courses. And what I saw, both in my own experience and my classmates, was tremendous activity and very little measurable progress. I figured that I got about an hour's worth of learning from every 20 hours of effort, and that's a generous calculation. So I would aim for productive use of every hour of a student's time, and I would also invite outside experts to come in and teach some of the discrete skills that law students have to learn for the first time as they try to put all of these things together in order to write effectively about law. And the reason I would bring people in from the outside is that since there are so many things going on, there's so many things that have to be learned at once, you've got to have people who can simplify. And you're not going to be able to simplify the elements of English grammar if you're just learning them for the first time. I mean, as a law professor or as an instructor of legal writing, if you're having to go to a handbook of grammar or a guide to the elements of composition yourself for the first time, you may be able to teach it, but you can't simplify, because simplification is the last thing that happens in the development of expertise. The first thing, of course, is that you gather lots of information, you begin slowly to process all that information, and you use it, you know, you teach with it, and after a number of years, then you're in a position where you can simplify, you can identify the first principles of the field, and then, and only then, can you teach it simply and plainly and clearly. At least that's my view. After teaching writing for over a decade, I can teach it. I can teach it simply, and I can teach it quickly, but that's the product of a dozen years teaching freshman composition. So I think for the writing skills, for particular writing skills, you need to bring someone in who can do three things in particular that I would, in fact, I wouldn't probably try to teach these things again myself, because I've been so desensitized. Just the syntactic options that every writer in the English language has, because most writers habitually use a few syntactic variants, and syntax just being sentence structure, they prefer a particular kind. I tend to use semicolons, and two simple sentences combined with a semicolon. Left to myself without an editor or without going back over it, everything would come out pretty much like that. And most people do favor a particular syntactic pattern. So I'd have someone come and teach the options, just as a way of increasing the options of your students, so they can identify sentence patterns, because 90% of them probably can't when they come into law school. And then I would have this person address the specialized syntactic needs of the legal writer. And those are not very, there are some, and they can be taught fairly quickly. The second topic is, I would have this expert address, is readability. And I'd have them teach a few of the basic principles of readability. The magic number 7, I'm not going to go into that. But at any rate, the reason that we have 7-digit telephone numbers is that that's about as many single items that can be retained in the short-term memory easily. If you know that and apply that to writing, then you've got to have closure after each group, or you know, shouldn't exceed seven items, seven words, seven sort of discrete concepts in a grouping. So you can't sort of spin things out and expect the reader to hold on to the words at the beginning. But if those things are easily taught, and once you know it forever. And it's very easy to revise if you've got those readability principles. And again, those can be fairly quickly taught. Then I'd have the elements of composition addressed briefly. What are the elements of composition? You know, things like audience and tone, just a checklist of them. You know, what are the things that you consider in a finished composition? What are the things that you must know before you begin to write? You have to identify your audience. You have to decide what effect you want to produce in your audience, so you consider tone. And those, again, are fairly easy to teach. Then particular elements of composition should be gone into in some detail. Paragraphing is the one that comes to mind immediately. How do you design a section? It's not the standard undergraduate paragraph with the topic sentence first. A section in legal writing is a particular kind of organization, and students need to be told how you work with paragraph blocks and how you use paragraphs to introduce, you know, paragraph, a short paragraph functions like a topic sentence, and then the parts of a conventional paragraph are expanded into paragraphs themselves, so that in legal writing you tend to have lots of shorter paragraphs than you would in other expository styles. Then I'd have the specialist talk about methods of research note-taking, because most specialists in composition have taught not only freshman composition, but writing the research paper. It's a standard basic course in English departments, and particularly in freshman composition departments. So you've got people who have paid attention to the details, to the methods of gathering information, note-taking, how to organize your information on note cards, and more sophisticated ways of keeping track of things so students don't have mountain ranges of Xerox cases to sort of wallow around in. Instead, you can give them choices of types of note-taking and information organization that you can get from your English department. You can get somebody who will be good at that. And that should help them with their classroom note-taking, because some methods of taking notes are very effective as far as capturing what goes on in class, and some methods are not. Now, I've taken notes for a whole quarter and at the end realized they were fundamentally useless and just thrown them away because I just wasn't organizing them, I wasn't writing the right things down. And there are people who have expertise in that. So I would ask someone like that to come talk to my students. And then the research specialist, I think, should also talk to law students about the ethics of research and writing. And this is the subject, I'm sure other people have talked about it, but I just haven't happened to have heard it discussed. But one of the things that happens to law students is that they quickly discover that they have a license to plagiarize if they're writing about the law. And as undergraduates, they probably would have been expelled from school if they had plagiarized the way law students quickly learn to do. You don't have to put everything in quotation marks. And the more accurately you use, the more carefully you duplicate the language in a case, the better off you're going to be when you try to write about it. And so the whole notion of patterns of words and sets of words and particular expressions being free for the use of students and law professors and lawyers, I think that carries over with law students into a sort of sometimes a fairly flaky style of research and writing. They tend not to be fastidious about sources and the way that they report. It's very easy to cheat when you write about the law, to throw in citations to cases that you haven't actually read or that you have only read the headnotes of. And I think that at the very beginning, it's important to instill a sense of real self-discipline and willpower when it comes to working with legal materials, because you've got to be honorable in your use of the materials, and that has to start early. You can't get sloppy. And the general license to plagiarize, I think, sometimes carries over into a sense that, you know, this is one big family, the legal profession, and we all excuse one another's uses of all this stuff, and it can become a less than conscientious process. Now, I'd also, two other kinds of experts that I would invite in if I were going to do this again are a rhetorician and a communications or speech expert. Now, the rhetorician you will probably find in a graduate program in composition and rhetoric, or you might in a classics department. And you want somebody who's trained in classical rhetoric, who will come and talk to the students when they, in an appellate advocacy course, a brief writing course, or maybe even in the spring at the end of the first year. But second year or third year would probably be best, because it's pretty rigorous. In the first year, you're about to die every single week anyway. The first week of law school for me was the longest week of my entire life, and I can't imagine introducing anything else into the curriculum. Certainly not classical rhetoric. But since undergraduates don't get this, I think every lawyer ought to know it. There's a small corpus of information. It hasn't changed for centuries. It's accessible. It's teachable. But again, you need somebody who's well-versed in it and experienced in it who can simplify it so that law students graduate with an understanding of what the major rhetorical devices are, so they can recognize them if they're being used in someone else's persuasive writing, or so they can use them themselves. Apparently there's someone, Professor Jim Lindgren at the University of Connecticut, who's teaching a legal rhetoric course, who has materials that might be useful. And then there's a fine book called, I won't be able to remember it, but Classical, if you're interested in it, I'll think of it later, can tell you. It's in the bibliography of legal writing in a nutshell. It's in the back, so it's the only classical rhetoric in the back, so it's there. Anyway, the third kind of expert I would bring in, and this would be for the third year, would be a communications or speech expert. And this would be someone who would be able to watch student performances, oral performances, and criticize them on the basis of experience with debaters or public speaking, so that law students in their last year, preferably, get workouts in thinking on their feet and expressing their thoughts clearly. By the third year, it's going to be law students have trouble asking simple questions. And I'm speaking from experience. I'm taking trial advocacy right now, and this is one of the things that we do. We have performance sections every week, and we're asking witnesses questions. We're interviewing clients, or we're direct and cross-examination of witnesses. And I have a terrible time asking short, simple questions. It took me half a quarter before I got to the point where my instructor wasn't sort of jumping up and down and complaining about nearly everything I did. And that's because you forget how to speak plainly. And somebody has to come in from the outside and say, this is how it should sound. You know, this is how to do it. This is how to talk plainly. So I'd have this plain speaking addressed to client interviewing, questioning of witnesses, talking with the jury, and then even talking with lawyers and judges, because you always have to say the important thing simply and clearly, and that takes practice when you've gone through a couple years of law school. Okay, the last thing I want to say about bringing in the non-lawyer is that you're going to have to work with your students, work with them about their attitudes towards non-lawyers. You won't be able to cure their disdain of the non-lawyer expert, but you can teach them to hide it. You can teach them to be receptive. Marjorie told me something last night that I think is a nice way to keep this in mind. There's a sort of proverb in her family that came out of some work on a construction crew. And the proverb is that the dumbest man on the gang knows something that you don't know. And I think I would talk seriously with law students before bringing any outside expert in and convey that sentiment to them, because they're likely to think that anybody who hasn't been through this is somehow missing in some essential area of intelligence and experience. And you need to prepare them so they can make the best use of this non-lawyer expert. Thank you. Oh, it's Edwin Corbett, Classical Rhetoric. Thank you.
Marilyn Walter from Brooklyn Law School, going to speak on collaborative learning techniques, peer evaluation.
To me, the strength of a legal writing course has always been in the one-to-one relationship between the student and the instructor. The instructor comments extensively on the student's work. The instructor has conferences with the students, and they talk about the student's work. And that is a very, very powerful relationship and a way of getting students, sometimes for the first time in their lives, to really concentrate on the words that they're putting down on paper. We tended to think, in my experience anyway, of the classroom as being less productive. I think it was less productive. That at worst, the classroom in legal writing could be like the classroom in any large lecture room, with the only difference being that there was a smaller number of students. You would have the students sitting there passively while the instructor would be saying, you really have to learn to write clearly. One of the things that we've tried to do at Brooklyn Law School, and I know a number of other law schools are doing the same thing, is to use collaborative learning techniques to make the most of the classroom hour. In addition to the function of making classroom learning fun and energetic in a way that it can't be if the instructor is doing most of the talking, collaborative learning is a way of enhancing the student's ability to develop his own skills. It increases the amount of effort that students make because instead of being anonymous members of a class, they are all participants in the collaborative learning tasks that are assigned. Basically, collaborative learning means that students learn some things particularly well through a process of working with people who are at the same level of skill that they're in. And there are two models that I'd like to talk about. One of them is collaborative groups. And collaborative group learning is done mainly in the classroom. The other is peer criticism. That's a process mainly done outside of the classroom by which students evaluate each other's work. What you do simply with collaborative groups in your classroom is have the students do certain tasks in groups of about 4 or 5. If your writing class has about 20 to 25 students in it, all you have to make sure is that you have a classroom that's big enough to hold about 5 clusters worth of students. Enough room so that when the groups are talking, they can't really overhear and be distracted by what the other groups are saying. Typically, a class has 2 sections to it. In the first section, the students are assigned a task in groups, and they will work on it in an hour class for something like 35 or 40 minutes. The second part of the class has the groups, if not physically come back to the entire class, at least swing around and listen to what the reports of all the other groups are on the topic. And in this phase, the instructor has a more active role. When you first, if you should decide to use collaborative learning, and I hope that you do, suggest to your class that this is what you would like them to do, I think you have to expect a few looks of skepticism. There is something about this process that reminds us all of elementary school, and it should not be surprising that that's the case because collaborative learning techniques were used at elementary school and high school long before we at law school became familiar with them. They've been used very successfully at the college level. And in fact, the book that I read that gave me an introduction to collaborative learning is a book by Ken Bruffy called A Short Course in Writing, which has a very helpful section on collaborative learning that I would recommend to all of you. I might add that you should expect skepticism not only from your students, but you may also get some skepticism from some of the writing instructors. One of the instructors told me a few weeks ago that when I first described this process and in fact had the instructors do some collaborative learning exercises over the summer, that he thought that he was very skeptical. He said this is just another one of those touchy-feely teaching techniques, and he was, I think, even a little embarrassed to be associated with it. He has since changed his mind and said that what has surprised him is how the collaborative groups seem to infuse the students with energy. After they have had 2.5 hours of class in another subject, and after most of them have spent a whole day at work. Those of us at the law school who are not evening students always marvel at how they possibly can survive, but they do. And he pointed out in one of the exercises that he did with his class, the students kind of dragged their way in at around 8:30. And he said, but when they were working in groups, they woke up. They just got very excited, fatigue dropped away. They really enjoyed what they were doing. And I think that that is one of the great pleasures of using these techniques, as well as the effectiveness that they have in teaching the students how to write. What you'll observe is first that there is dead silence in the room once the students are in groups. And you have to get over your fear that this is a failure and that it will never work. During that period of silence, the students are either reading the assignment you've given them or are a little bit embarrassed and don't want to be the first to speak. But after a couple of minutes, somebody in one of the groups will start saying something, and then you'll hear another voice from another group. After about 5 minutes, you can't hear any individual voices at all. What you hear is a kind of buzz. And what you observe is that even the quietest students, even the ones that are shyest, feel comfortable talking in these small groups. I think that we've observed that the students frequently are more at ease in the legal writing classes than they are in their large lecture classes of 90 students. There's something about making a fool of yourself in front of 20 people, which is not as bad as making a fool of yourself in front of 90. Well, the same thing happens when it's only 4 or 5. And they are also very tolerant of each other's errors. And so it's a way of encouraging as close to 100% participation by a student in a classroom hour as I think it is possible to get. It's always hard for me to break up the groups because I rarely am able to maintain that level of energy once I bring the groups back. I think it's necessary, though, because it is helpful to them when the groups report. If, in fact, some students have misinterpreted an assignment or gotten confused, it's a way of having them hear other ideas and perhaps bringing them more in line with what you as the instructor think is the appropriate way to be addressing a particular problem. The task that you give the students has to be limited. If it's too long, they'll spend too much time reading. If it's too complicated, they won't be able to focus on things. They'll be distracted, and then they won't be able to accomplish what you want. 3 of the examples that I attached to the materials in this book describe different kinds of collaborative learning exercises. The first one has 3 sample thesis paragraphs. All of these examples were written by students of mine. Page 22. I gave this to my students in about the second or third week of school, after we had talked a little bit about what a thesis paragraph was, and asked them to evaluate which they thought was the best thesis paragraph, the most helpful, and why. I cannot say that all of the students agreed with me. And I guess I hesitate to say the one that I thought was right, but the one that I thought was right. Not all of them saw that, I think in part because they had differing views, in part because this was pretty early in the year and I was asking them to do things that they weren't completely comfortable in doing. They weren't yet as sensitive to what was in the writing as they would become later on in the semester. My guess is that if I gave them the same assignment a month later, they would feel much more comfortable and much more skillful in analyzing the pieces of writing. I included the second sample, the one on citation form, just to give you an idea of that you will be amazed at the kind of task that students will get rabid about. Tasks that if you gave them to them individually, they would have little or no interest in doing at all. The third task is the most complicated one, and that's the 2-page argument. The writing specialist at our school had suggested that it would help the students do edits if they could do a topic sentence outline. I wasn't sure exactly what to tell the students, and so I thought before I asked them to do an edit of each other's work, I would have them do a collaborative exercise in class, asking them to do the same thing. And I asked them to look at each of the paragraphs in this exercise, to write a topic sentence for the paragraph, unless they thought that the topic sentence that was there was adequate. What they were able to discover from the process of writing topic sentences, which of course involved their reading each paragraph and determining what the paragraph was really about, was to see that the student in the argument had really made most of his opponent's arguments in Section A, and that the first paragraph in Section B never referred to the facts of the case and was never related to the argument the student was making. They weren't able to find topic sentences in some of the other paragraphs in Section B until someone thought to look at the very last sentence. And we agreed that that was probably a pretty useful topic sentence that was simply in the wrong place. Since I did feel that the students were able to get something from this exercise in collaborative learning, making a topic sentence outline, I decided that I would ask them to make a topic sentence outline when they edited each other's briefs. And that brings me to the second kind of collaborative learning model, which is called peer criticism. In peer criticism, students evaluate each other's work. They don't grade it, but they evaluate it. And it's a very valuable means of having them learn to evaluate their own work, which, after all, is our goal, since we're not going to be there forever. It's hard for students to do this. They feel embarrassed. They're afraid of hurting each other's feelings, and maybe what's worse, they're afraid of having a friend of theirs look at their work and think that it's really not very good. And so you need to try to give them some preparation, not only in the task, but also in giving them a sense of what the purpose of peer criticism is. To tell them that when they are practicing law, there may be a number of times when colleagues of theirs will say, "Could you take a look at this, please, and tell me what you think?" And it will be possible for them to be very helpful to their colleagues if they learn the process of evaluating someone's work in a positive way. We ask them to be tactful, to say good, not just to tell what's wrong with it. We ask them to give details to support generalizations they make, so that instead of straight contempt, there's a sentence that describes something and then gives examples, which is a lot easier to deal with. We ask them at an early stage to suspend their judgment about whether they agree with the answer and simply to evaluate the technique. In traditional peer criticism, there are three phases, and we've tended to modify this. The first phase involves the students writing a descriptive outline. They would write an outline of each paragraph, indicating what each paragraph says and what each paragraph does. In the second phase, they would evaluate the work along the lines of organization, writing, and technique. And then finally, not until the third phase, would they make comments on the substance. The way we use this process at Brooklyn Law School is to have the students edit each other's moot court briefs. The students write two drafts of a moot court brief, and when they have written the first draft, they not only have a copy for the writing instructor, but they have another copy which they give to another student in the class. What I have usually done is said to the students, if there is someone whose editing partner they would like to be, that the two students should simply let me know, and that I will honor that. And I also ask them if they want to be on a particular side of the issue to let me know that too, and have found that that works very well. They feel they have a little control over what's happening to them, and I'm always surprised to see that the preference of students seems to break down with half wanting to be on one side and half wanting to be on the other without any manipulation on my part. We have the students edit briefs on the same side of the issue that they're on. When we didn't do this, we found that they were really trying to argue against the substance of what the person was writing rather than evaluating the writing itself. This edit is 5% of the student's grade. And we grade it for a couple of reasons. First, we think that it's important, and certainly one of the ways that we all at law school convey to our students that certain things are important and certain things aren't important is by whether we assign it a grade. We also recognize that they spend a lot of time on an edit, particularly if the edit is well done, and that they should get some credit for that. We have not had any difficulty with another issue that someone raised, and that was whether students would be reluctant to really help each other out because they would fear that they would lose a competitive advantage. It hasn't been a problem so far, but I assume that the grade would have the same function of rewarding them for the good work that they do. I asked my students to do three things. I told them I wanted them to do line editing. I said I wanted a general comment sheet at the end, which dealt with four basic topics: organization, analysis, style, and the formal elements of the brief. And third, I asked them for the topic sentence outline, which is a little bit like the descriptive and evaluative part of a traditional peer criticism exercise. I told them that if they thought the topic sentence was good, they should leave it. If not, they should revise it. And what I found, although I haven't seen all of the students' work, is that what they were able to do was really remarkable. I think because in the process of writing topic sentences, they looked at paragraphs in a way they hadn't before and really thought about what the paragraph was about and what its purpose was in the argument. I also think that the topic sentences that they wrote for the other person's brief were consistently much better than the ones they wrote for their own papers, in part because they were concentrating on it, in part because they had some distance from it, and in part because of lots of things that I still haven't figured out. They were able, I thought, in quite a sophisticated way to identify certain kinds of problems. One is the problem that we've been talking about all day. An argument which is really a series of cases, beginning with something like in X versus Y, or another case in which the court said, I think it's a persistent problem because it's so hard to help the students get over that, to help them look for issues rather than cases, and for arguments rather than cases. Some students noticed that there were a lot of what I would call paragraph fragments, paragraphs which were one sentence or two sentences long. And they frequently could be taken care of either by being added to the preceding paragraph where they belonged or the next paragraph where they belonged. Or if the ideas were important enough, then the students would say, develop this more fully. Or if it was useless, then the student would say, get rid of it. It doesn't add anything. The students noticed that there were paragraphs with no topic sentences. Or if there was a topic sentence, it was at the end of the paragraph, or maybe about three or four sentences down, and they could simply recommend that the person revise the paragraph. They noticed. But if you look at your topic sentence outline, I think you'll see where your organization needs to be cleaned up a little. The first paragraph should lay the groundwork for the rest of paragraphs under point one, but it is, in my opinion, a useless paragraph. I think it would be clearer to the reader if you explained the basic elements of negligence in a medical malpractice framework to set the stage to discuss the elements separately. You do not have a topic sentence that deals with duty. As a result, you fluctuate back and forth between several aspects of the issue of duty, which makes this paragraph hard to follow. You're struggling with two aspects, at least, that could be treated in two paragraphs. One, the fact that a duty is owed to a fetus and a fetus is foreseeable. This is a wrongful life claim. And two, that the parents act as the fetus's agent. You've got good points in there, but they're lost in the reader's struggle to follow you. In contrast, your paragraph on breach of duty is excellent and flows well and is extremely well supported by facts about amniocentesis and Down syndrome. This is not my average student. this is one of my best students, and I think did an absolutely extraordinarily fine job of doing an edit, which she indicated took her a very long time. Some of the students didn't work as hard, and some of the students don't have her ability. But I think it indicates the level that it is possible for some students to reach. And the advantage to them is, secondarily, that they will have another set of comments from someone else in addition to mine, so that when they rewrite their own briefs, they'll have a different perspective. But I think more than that, it sensitizes them to the process of writing in a way that I hope will be very useful to them when they rewrite their own briefs. Thank you.
Our last speaker this afternoon is Ralph Brill, Chicago, Kent.
I will be very brief, and all I'm going to do is to describe what's going to happen tonight. Some of you may know something about computers. I have a hunch from talking to some of you that most of you know not too much, and that they're a little scary to you. I think most of you are familiar with Westlaw and Lexis. I think all of our schools have those by now. Some of you may be familiar with some of the computer-assisted instruction exercises developed mainly at the University of Minnesota and at several other schools, and torts, and civil procedure, evidence, bankruptcy, and a few other subjects. So far, there have not been very many developments in the areas of legal writing, research, or reasoning in developing either computer-assisted instruction exercises or other software that are aids in either teaching or using or improving writing. But there are some rapidly developing activities in those areas now. For example, Westlaw does have a computer-assisted instruction exercise on using Westlaw. It's a very good one on formulating search requests. Several of us are working on a book with some computer exercises on legal writing, which we will call Legal Write. There are a number of programs that are also aids for students in improving their writing. Word processing programs are obvious, but there are some other kinds of things, individual software programs on spell checks and grammar checks and things of that sort. The most sophisticated of these is something called the Writer's Workbench, which was developed by Bell Labs. And Leonard Fraes, who was the developer of the Writer's Workbench, will be here tonight to demonstrate that at 7 o'clock. What the Writer's Workbench is a series of 35 or more programs that analyze writing against models that you program in. He developed it for technical writing, and they put in standards of good technical writing to compare their own technical writer's work against. But it can be reprogrammed against any other kind of models of good writing, whether it's creative writing or legal writing. And it will then analyze a document against the standards set up by its own analysis of the previous works you programmed on several different bases. Sentence length, for example, complexity of language, grammar, spelling, diction, and so on, active and passive voice. And it will give you a computer printout of, for example, this document has 20 sentences of 20 words or more. It will then tell the student good legal writing normally should have short sentences. It will highlight what sentences are too long and allow the students to decide whether they want to change them or not. It also has tutorials built within it that will help the student show to learn how to shorten sentences or how to improve the diction. So what I've done is to send Mr. Fraes three samples of briefs, three memoranda, and three law review articles. Two out of the three in each case were pretty good, and the third was a student selected at random. And he will demonstrate his analysis under all these programs of those three types of writing. And of course, we'll do it on the screen here in the room. We fixed up the monitors. I promise they'll be a little more less fuzzy this evening, and we'll cover the lights so that you'll be able to see a little bit better. When Mr. Fraes is through, and we hope you'll ask some questions of him as well, then Ron Stout, who is the director of the IIT Chicago Kent Center for Law and Computers, will describe some of the activities of that group. For the past year and a half, excuse me, we have integrated our computer lab into the legal writing program and several other programs, and he will describe the experience of teaching students how to use computers as aids for drafting their legal writing assignments, both as word processors, as organizers, as outliners, as database storage managers and retrievals, and communications. And he'll talk about some of the things that are planned for the future. And then Jim Sproul, who is also a member of our faculty, will describe two things. One, the use of computers in document design, drafting, which is something that we sort of leave out a lot when we talk about legal writing, the importance of drafting. And he has developed over the last 6 years a system of, really has an artificial intelligence built within it, where the computer will accept information programmed into it by a typist and will spit out a complicated legal document, not just the boilerplate that some of the typical programs have, but with tax analyses, for example, a will with the pour-over trust, things of that sort. Now, this is not designed to replace lawyers. They're programmed by lawyers. In fact, what his system does is to teach lawyers how to program their own documents to do this. The ones he will demonstrate tonight, for example, were done by law students working in our clinic several years ago. He will also describe for you a system that he has developed for teaching Westlaw and Lexis at the same time. The students don't have to learn two different systems. It makes them both compatible. The same keystroke will do the same functions for both, or different functions for both, but the students will know that. Following that demonstration, that will take about an hour and a half total, with some break in between, you will be asked, if you wish, to step into the two computer labs that we have next door. And each of the computers has been set up with a different program that is available, and you will have people there to help you to go through some of these programs. For example, you can play with Framework, which is this interactive word processor, data storage, organizer, communications, spreadsheets program. It does all those things at once. We have one sample from the book that we're working on Legal Right, which is on subject-verb agreement. You'll be able to play that exercise if you like. Several other of those kinds of programs. You don't have to be afraid. You can't break the computer. There will be people there who will help you run through them. If you don't want to, of course, then you don't have to stay. You're free to go at that point. So you may want to make your dinner plans accordingly, whether you think you want to stay around late and play with the computers. In that case, you're going to have to get dinner between 5:30 and 7 to be back. If you think you're not going to be interested in that sort of thing after the presentation, you might want to make dinner plans elsewhere for later in the evening. At this point, we will be taking a coffee break in 6:41, and then you are to go to the new workshops, which we have reformed. Have you talked about that, Helen? Okay. Thank you.